Hey everybody, Mike Lejeune here with Game Changers for Government Contractors. And we have Troy with us here today to talk about a fascinating topic. And I'm not being sarcastic in any way here. I am looking forward to talking about a day in the life of a contracting officer. So before we jump into that, Troy, take a minute, tell everybody a little bit about who you are and what you do.
Yeah, sure. My name is Troy Francis. I've been in the government contracting space now for going on 17 years. And I've been fortunate to work in both the federal sector, as well as the local government sector here in the District of Columbia. I started my career with the Department of Defense, specifically at Military Sealift Command. I was there for about 7.5 years or so. After I was at MSC, I spent some time for about 6.5 years. I had my own business that I started doing event planning, management, and design, which I loved doing, did great at it. But after about 6.5 years or so, there was many nights and weekends I could never get back and ultimately burned myself out. So then I wanted to switch gears. And I remembered, like, I enjoyed procurement. Like, I enjoyed the government contracting space and went back into it, going to the Department of Health and Human Services. I went to a mid-sized agency there called BARDA, one of those government acronyms that stands for Biomedical Advanced Research and Development Authority. And they develop all your vaccines, therapeutics, diagnostics, any public health emergent event. They develop all the medical countermeasures for that. And then after I spent about 6 years there, I went to the local government. I've now been at the district government, serving the Department of Transportation here for going on 2 years, almost getting close to that. So I've got the full gamut from doing my own thing, working in the federal sector, working in the private sector. And ultimately, like, I'm a government contracting expert. I love this stuff. I love educating private industry on some of the nuances of it, demystifying it. Same thing with other government agencies, other colleagues that I have, helping them out as well. So I appreciate being here.
That's awesome. It's rare that I get to talk to people that have been on both sides of that coin. And so you've seen a lot of it. You have a great amount of knowledge here to share with us today on this topic. So like I said before we started recording, it's rare that I'm this excited when I see one of these come in, because it's just a topic we don't talk about a whole lot. I think we talk around it. Right? We talk around it, but not necessarily directly about it. So it's a day in the life of a contracting officer. Why don't we just start off with what actually happens behind the scenes when you're establishing like new requirements or working on getting ready for a new contract? What is that like for a contracting officer in their world?
I think a good way to put this in context to listeners out there is when you think of a small business or even a mid-sized business or a large one and the opportunities that you're competing for that are out there, you have a pipeline strategy, you have opportunities that you've got ready to compete against, and that's a great portfolio. So now multiply that by about 10. And that's what a contracting officer is dealing with on a regular basis. For instance, serving the Department of Transportation here in the District of Columbia, over the last fiscal year, we had well over 300 different procurement actions. So like that kind of shows you the volume that we can deal with. And that's comparatively speaking, that's about equivalent to a smaller size federal agency. Now, if you're at a larger federal agency, maybe you're doing some larger procurements that take longer. So maybe the portfolio isn't as wide or the breadth of it isn't as wide. So that may play a factor in it, but you're balancing a lot at once. With private sector, they have targeted agencies that you're dealing with. They have targeted program managers that they're dealing with, whereas we're wide open to the market. And so we're fielding all opportunities there. And what really happens behind the scenes is we have to manage those expectations with industry. So not only are we doing pretty thorough market research to see who is actually out there that could compete for some of these opportunities, especially if it's something that we need to develop a new solution. If we don't already have some incumbent that's been doing the work for years, if it isn't like a tried and true service that's commercialized, that we know has been doing for years. And we want to go out there and make sure we can source companies that can perform and provide the best solution, whether it's research and development, whether it's a new technology, whether it's a new service we're asking for, whether it's doing a complete restructure of an agency, whatever it may be. Market research there is pretty thorough. Like that's a very thorough part of our job. And then after that, we have to determine our acquisition strategy. When we think about acquisition strategy or procurement strategy, we have to look at the opportunities out there, the companies out there, and think about what's the best way to formulate the requirements for this. Usually you can go to industry. That's what I usually recommend for our client agencies is let's speak to industry more before we put a solicitation out there. Let's talk to them more about what actually do we need? How should we even think about going about doing this? what capabilities do you all actually have before putting something out there and expecting that we're going to get great proposals and great responses? So doing a lot of acquisition planning, understanding how to form the requirements, speaking to industry, that would be part of market research, are the first steps of any procurement that we do. In addition to that, we have to go through some of our legal arms. So we have attorneys, Office of Attorney Generals, we have Office of General Counsels. We have different approvals that we have to go through before we can even get to the point of publicizing a solicitation. And that's ultimately what you would want. I mean, I think if you're a taxpayer, you'd want to have those checks and balances to make sure that we're not abusing our authority and we're just spending money frivolously. That's why at times it can take a little bit longer than expected for a solicitation to come out, where you've submitted a response to an RFI and you're like, what happened? You know, where's the solicitation? You know, I spoke to the program manager 3 months ago. What happened? Well, I mean, there's a lot of eyes that get put to the equation, a lot of voices, a lot of comments, and a lot of revisions, a lot of changes before we actually have a final document that goes out there. In addition to that, we also had to formulate a real, true, fair, reasonable estimate for any procurement we do. So until that's finalized, we can't put together a viable estimate. So once that's all ready, once it's publicized, we're out on the street. Depending on the solicitation, we can get anywhere from a couple proposals to dozens. If you're in an environment where you've got dozens, that takes time. That takes a lot of evaluation time. And we'll have evaluation panels, source selection panels, or what we call them. But if you're going through, in some cases, 12, 15, maybe even up to 20, depending on how competitive the procurement is, that can take months of time. There's usually what I consider like this cone of silence that occurs after proposals go or come in. Companies are out there and they're like, what's happening? Where are we at in the process? Can you give me an update? And usually the reason why there's not much of an update is because we're still under evaluation, because we've got other competitors, because it's taking a while to get through them. Because you have to make sure that we're addressing things objectively in our evaluations. That's another key. We want to make sure that we're doing this on an equal playing field independently of each other before we actually get to a determination for who we have an intent to award with or who we want to negotiate with, who's in the competitive range before we get to an award. So there's a lot of steps along the way. There's a lot of checks and balances. I think that's something that private industry doesn't get to see behind the scenes. They submit their proposal and then they kind of wait. So that just gives you a general framework of what happens. And then when we get to negotiations, I mean, we've all been there, whether you're private industry, government side, those can also take months depending on how complex, large the requirement is. And you may not be the only one that we're negotiating with. Again, if there are 5 to 10 offers out there in the competitive range, we're going to be negotiating with 5 to 10 offers and multiply that times months at a time. This is why some of the large scale procurements, more complex procurements, or just highly competitive procurements can sometimes take a year or more. And that's just the reality of it. But again, it's all done with the intent of having procurement integrity as the key aspect to it and having checks and balances so that we're actually spending taxpayer money in the most optimal way.
If you're struggling with your government contracting business, I want to encourage you today to go sign up for a free coaching session with me. You can go in the description of this podcast. There's a link to my calendar, and you can go pick a time where we can sit down for 30 minutes, talk about what you're doing right, what you're doing wrong, what you should change. And then if coaching makes sense for you, I'll actually go over the options on how you can get started with coaching so we can take your business to the next level. Now let's get back into this episode. That's a lot going on in the background.
Yeah.
Simple way to put it. That is just on, like, as you're trying to get new requirements and not necessarily addressing, you've already got some contracts that you're dealing with. You're dealing with the unsolicited folks that are continually hounding you. You're going to conferences or events or doing something else. You know, that's just on these new contracts. I'm kind of curious on your take on something. I've had a thought for a while. And as I've watched the industry, you see a lot of different things shrink. You see the industrial base shrink. The DOD in their small business report last year, or maybe it was earlier this year, talked about how the industrial base had shrunk 50%.
Yeah.
Yet our requirements continue to grow, right? They continue to grow. The contracting officer base has shrunk significantly over the years for various reasons. Mm-hmm. Is part of the solution having more contracting officers? Would more contracting officers lighten the load and allow the government to do this not only quickly, but more efficiently? Or is that just throwing more cooks in the kitchen? Like, what's your thoughts on that?
It's a slippery slope. And I do think that from my experience, my perspective, I don't think there's enough talented expert contracting officers out there that have mastered their particular industry. And I think sometimes it's hit or miss depending on the agency. And I know any company out there can probably relate. Not all agencies are created equal. So some agencies, you're like, man, this is brutal to deal with, versus another agency where you're like, wow, these folks are put together well, and this is a breeze, and it seems like they know what they're doing, and they can answer every single question I have very thoroughly. So I think that's part of the issue, is just the general recruitment amongst the agencies. And in general, I think that becoming a contracting officer or procurement executive is not something that people seek out when they're going to school, when they're getting a degree. And it's just something that the recruiting isn't really there. I mean, when I got into the industry, I was fortunate because the Department of Defense was recruiting at my undergrad at UNC Chapel Hill. I had that opportunity presented to me, but I know that that's just not common. It really isn't. I think that plays a part in it. But as far as getting more contracting officers, I think that that's one aspect, but I think the training programs in general could be better enhanced across the board, across all the agencies, whether it's DOD, HHS, you name it. I think that that's another component that gets lost in translation. And I've been through some of the training programs. And again, not all of them are created equal. Some are better than others. And also, I think another component to government contracting is the DOD over the years has gotten a little stale, in my opinion, over the last 10, 15, 20 years with the way they do contracts. They've tried to freshen it up, be a little more innovative over the last 4 or 5 years. I know they've changed some things in their defense authorization bill. Trying to encourage not always doing firm fixed price contracts. You know, they're trying to mix it up. And so when you mix it up and you do more innovative procurements, that's more interesting for people to do on a day-to-day. And that's what I learned in my career. When I was at DOD, you know, I had a good mix of different types of contracts, different types of procurements. Then when I went to Department of Health Human Services, I helped launch a division from scratch called a Division of Research, Innovation, and Ventures, or DRIVE. And we were like the beta testers. We were able to do things that were not done in HHS ever before, and any general government agency had not been done, which I can get to later. So when you have that mindset going into it and you allow your employees to think creatively and think critically, I think it makes your job and the position more enticing. So that probably plays a factor in it.
I think we've seen across the board, not just in government, but in the commercial world, a shift is probably the best way I can describe it in our labor force. And there's like this huge, probably two generation era of people that are just built differently than you and I. You know, it's very odd. That's probably the kindest way I could say it, on how they approach their work and what they do and their pay they make. It's just a very interesting time. And it's not necessarily an age range of people, but more of like almost a cultural thing that I've seen, where they're not necessarily learning these things on their own and working on their own craft. I can't tell you how many books I've read on what I do and training videos I've watched and courses I've bought, how much I've invested in myself being better at this, where there's such a reliance on, well, you pay me to do this and you're only paying me X number of dollars. I'm not necessarily saying that's contracting officers specifically or anything, but there's just, we've lost something in our work ethic in our country. And there's probably this 10 to 15, maybe 20 year age range that I see most common, where it's like, guys got to get it together because you're the next generations, right? The next two generations. But I see 40 year olds in that bucket sometimes too. So it's a very interesting thing. But I think it just, government and commercial mirror each other in a lot of those ways, because we have seen like an exodus in one situation there, where people have left this market. And so they took that knowledge with them, that work ethic with them. And the knowledge is the big thing, you know, all that intellectual property that's rolling around in their brain, that when you leave, you just, it goes out the door, and it's not in a manual somewhere. It's not in a training session or book. It's just gone. So there's been a lot of that lost.
Yeah. I mean, I think what really goes for anybody is you're going to learn the most on the job and through others. That's how I've gotten to this point in my career. I've been very fortunate in that regard. I've had really great opportunities. I've learned from a lot of great people. But you also have to have the willingness to want to think outside the box or question the way something's done. And I think that is what doesn't happen enough in the government, is questioning the way the status quo is, especially in the large monolithic type agencies that have been doing it their way forever, that have a policy for a policy for a policy. and questioning those, questioning certain regulations is critical. And so what I try to do is educate private industry on some of the regulations that impact them, what they mean, how they apply, and ways they could consider revising them or lobbying against them or getting them changed. Because in my opinion, the best way to get rules and regulations and things revised or removed is through private industry. I mean, we can present our case internally through a government agency, but to be honest with you, it takes longer. It's not as effective. So part of what I do is just try to educate people on the general process and policies and regulations we have to follow. Hopefully they can make their own decisions on how they want to pursue those.
Challenging the status quo sound like the words of a troublemaker. That's my thing. You know, I often get asked to join like a board or something like that. And they're like, oh man, we're having a whole lot of trouble right now and things in shambles. I'm like, well, that's a great pitch, number one. But number two, I always say, are you willing to burn it to the ground and start over? Because that's what I bring to the table. I'm going to challenge every status quo, like everything that you hold sacred is going to get challenged. Because if it's in shambles, if it's not work, even if it's not totally a dumpster fire, but if you're having some serious problems, the thinking that got you here won't get you out of the problem. And so we've got to change that thinking if we want to fix it. And so that's where I come in and I'm like, man, I'm definitely a troublemaker because I'm going to challenge all of these things. One of the things that I think is really interesting from your perspective, that contracting officer's perspective, is understanding how companies can be more competitive. Because they're always wanting to know, that's one of the questions they ask us, is like, how can we be more competitive? Because they look at this business and say, the reason I can't win is because there's 20 proposals and they're meeting with my competitors. And so how do I get more competitive to enhance my odds of winning a contract? I'm curious what your couple of pieces of advice are for folks that are listening that want some sort of edge.
I think you have to master a niche. And I think we've gotten to a point in the business world where it's become more customized as time has gone on. You can't have a catch-all type of company. You need to be a master at one thing that stands out and be known as the expert in that. And once you become the expert or the master in that, and you have that specialized niche conquered, that's when I think you can start to resonate with government agencies. And that's when I think you can resonate with specific program managers looking for specific needs. And I think it just has to be more targeted. I think that that's something that a lot of small businesses struggle with, is to know where to shoot their target and to know exactly who to meet in the organization. Where does their specialization actually lie with what their mission is, what they're trying to buy? And they seem to miss the mark sometimes. But once you can get that mastered, and once you can actually, you know, start working as a subcontractor on some government contract, because that's usually how they all start, small businesses in particular, you will eventually start meeting the other people in the room in the conversations, having weekly updates, technical progress updates, even as the subcontractor, and you will start making relationships with some of those program managers, some of those decision makers and agencies, but you've got to be known as the master in it. And then over time, you can start building an ecosystem for your business. I think that's the number one thing, in my opinion.
I really appreciate you saying that. It sounds like a conversation I have a lot with folks. I mean, I was talking with a guy earlier today, and he has a lot of experience. I even told him, I said, look, I value the fact that you're an entrepreneur and you're hustling, man. You're hustling. You're doing whatever it takes to bring money in your business. And that is great in the commercial market. It's probably going to serve you well in the government market. But if you walk into a contracting officer's office and your capabilities statement shows that you provide dumpsters, you're a general contractor, you do plumbing, you do electrical, you do demolition. Oh, and you do a little bit of tech stuff. Mm-hmm. It's not going to fly. Right. This isn't a hypothetical. This is what the guy does. And he's like, I just don't understand why it's not working. And I'm like, your capability statement says you do anything from cybersecurity to janitorial. That's why it's not working. And then on the flip side, I had another conversation with a guy who said, hey, somebody came in my office the other day and they said, we only do one thing and we do it really, really well. That stood out to him. When he saw their capability statement, he was like just blown away. Like, this company knows who they want to be when they grow up. They're laser focused in it and it's all they care about. Mm-hmm. And that opened the door to have a conversation. I can imagine you probably get 100, 200, maybe 500 emails a month from people that are all saying, hey, we do all this stuff and we'd love a contract because we're a small business. We're an SDVOSB. We're a fill in the alphabet soup of certifications. And there's a 5%, a 3%, to whatever requirement. You know, yeah. They're spouting off all these things, but they're not talking about the one thing they do or even the value they provide. And it's like, it's so easy to go, seen it. For me, I get solicited all the time for stuff via email. And the moment I see, like, it's usually the first line, I'm reaching out to you because I'd like to sell you this whatever. Delete. The only time I ever open that is if it stands out. It's just the only time. And so I can imagine that's part of what's going on behind the scenes on a daily basis, is you either sifting through it or having to say, there's so much of this trash. It's like junk mail that I just have to throw away because I can't even be bothered with it, given the fact that I'm actually trying to award contracts.
Yeah. To respond to your point, I get hundreds of those on a monthly basis. And it's really just like a blanket statement. Hey, we're a service disabled veteran owned business and we do this and that. And it's like, why would I care? What do you actually do? And then also, why aren't you going through the proper channels that we've established for you to get your foot in the door to present whatever product or service it is that you offer? And some agencies do this better than others. When I was working at BARDA with the Department of Health and Human Services, they do a very good job of this. And they have what they call tech watches, where they bring in companies just on a rolling basis to present the products and technologies that they're in development and seeing some of their capabilities under and having a Q&A open forum session. We also had an accelerator network there that supported our drive division that went out there and fielded opportunities and sourced companies and started finding companies that had specific expertise and brought them our way and solicited them for us, essentially. So there's some agencies that do it a lot better, but you got to go through those channels versus just sending a blanket email out there and praying it's going to work, because it's just not. What I recommend too is if there are any type of pre-proposal or pre-solicitation sessions, which tend to exist for larger or more complex procurements, but they still can happen pretty frequently depending on the agency. That's where you can get face-to-face with some of those decision makers and you can actually start having an open forum to ask questions that might work for you to determine if this is the right opportunity. And I think a lot of businesses don't take advantage of that. They wait until solicitations on SAM.gov, whatever website's out there. They're like, all right, let me submit my proposal. And then they're hoping for an awesome reward at the end of it. The reality is, if that's the first time you're hearing about something, you're way too late. Like you should have been talking to these people during that acquisition planning phase I was mentioning way back at the beginning of this episode. That's what you need to be having conversations before there's even a requirement written. Because that's when you can ask the questions, you can present your expertise, and it will help influence and shape some of the requirements that come out from agencies.
I 100% agree. And I think for a lot of folks, the challenge is they just don't know what to do. There's so much noise in the market on what to do. It is mind-boggling. I would say, this may or may not surprise you, the number one question that I get asked from people entering this market, brace yourself, is what websites do I need to go on to place bids? Number one question, where do I need to go punch in my numbers and hit submit? I don't know if it's the movie War Dogs or what it is that has driven more people to us to say, hey, that's what I thought this was. You know, you just fill out some RFPs, you put some price quotes in and you hit submit and then they just choose somebody. Isn't that how it works? So people are just looking for websites. And I'm like, man, that's the easiest question. You know, to find what websites to put it in. The hard stuff is all of the strategy and those kind of things. And it's interesting when people come and that's the question that they have. It's kind of wild.
Yeah, I think it's a lot of times businesses view doing business with the government as like this wall they have to climb, or like it's a very transactional relationship. And the reality is, it's just people. It's people making decisions. That's it, like anywhere. And so if you aren't building those relationships and getting your face in front of their face, you're going to struggle. Ultimately, you're not going to be able to influence the way that you can potentially do business with that agency at the end of the day.
And, you know, there's the follow-up to me saying, hey, almost exactly what you did, relationships, strategy, time. The follow-up is always, well, isn't there a faster way? Because that sounds like a lot of work. And it's like, no, it's a lot of work. Can you win some RFPs just by placing bids? Absolutely. It's a numbers game and you don't necessarily have the time. I was talking to somebody earlier today who's fairly a novice in this industry, and it sounded like the quote was very simple and it took him 5.5 hours just to put together the quote. that's 5.5 hours on a quote. That's not an RFP. It was just a quote. It was a very simple job. But guess what? If it took you 5.5 hours to do that, it's probably going to take you 50 to put together the proposal when they have an actual big proposal that comes out. So you're just dabbling in like an $8,000 job and you just wasted 5 hours on something you don't understand, which there's a learning curve. And one of the best ways to learn is just doing it, right? That's a great way to learn. But there's so much more involved in all of this. Are there any trends that you're seeing on your side, whether it is in the procurement side, innovative contract vehicles, strategies that contracting officers are using? Are you seeing some things on there that you can share with folks?
Yeah, I think they are trying to boost up innovation in the way that they're procuring stuff. As I mentioned, the defense authorization bill, I think just a couple of years ago, they pretty much made it clear that we're not just going to do firm fixed price for everything that's commercial businesses. Like, we're going to actually want you to consider what is the best way to approach this requirement or opportunity versus this just rubber stamp way of doing business. I think that's one good push, because the DOD is a large agency. They have a lot of influence in other agencies. Department of Health and Human Services, they've been very innovative, at least in my experience there, and some of the vehicles we put together. For example, I know other transactions or other transaction authority has floated around a lot, OTAs. So those are ways in which a lot of agencies can just work outside the FAR, the Federal Acquisition Regulation, and be a little more creative and create governance terms and conditions from scratch, that just basically how private industry does business with private industry, just the same way. Now, it's specific to certain types of projects. Like, you can't just use OTAs for everything, but you see that a lot more. For instance, one of the procurements we did in the Department of Human Services in Drive was called BARDA Ventures. What this was, we formed a contract with a company that used venture capital methods and practices to basically establish a venture fund and invest in companies on our behalf, which sounds wild. Like, you're relying on this VC company to use taxpayer money to invest on behalf of the government. Sounds insane. But reality is, we're not VC experts. We don't do the due diligence of which companies that we could potentially invest in that might have a commercially valuable product and get a return on investment. Like, we don't understand that world. That's just not what we did. You know, we did biomedical R&D. But we wanted to see if there was an alternative to how we did business. Instead of non-dilutive funding, we wanted to do something that said, hey, if we invest in some of these companies that produce a return on investment, we could actually get the money back, send it back to Treasury, and we have a self-sustaining funding vehicle and not have to ask for more taxpayer dollars. And so basically the goal there was focus on some later stage investments. We had a one-to-one match that we required from other investors. So this was co-funded and we shared the risk. And ultimately all it takes is just one home run company out of the portfolio of 10 to 15 that works and hits. And then you have an exit strategy and you can get your return on investment. Like, that's something new for a government agency to do that. So that was pretty cool. And we used different authorities for that. Another vehicle we did was called the Easy BAA. Or Easy Broad Agency Announcement. Broad agency announcements are used in a lot of R&D agencies. And it's basically just this open solicitation. You can submit your proposal on a rolling basis for certain areas of interest that they are considering investing their research and investment dollars in. And they'll consider your white paper. Is this something that's viable? Something we want to consider? And then from there, you know, determine if they want to move forward with a full proposal. The Easy BAA streamlined this. When we created this, we never knew that we were going to have a massive pandemic occur just half a year or so later. So this vehicle we created from scratch got put to the ultimate stress test, because BARDA was one of the agencies directly attributed to developing some of the diagnostic kits, therapeutics, and other vaccines to help save lives. And that was crazy to see that actually work come to fruition, because I had a hand in putting that together and getting that out there. And we got stuff awarded from proposal through evaluation to award in as fast as 9 days. And that was a part of just the way the world was at the time, but it's also the mechanisms we set up for it. Those are two pretty innovative vehicles that I'm pretty proud of. They're still existing today. They're running pretty smoothly and well. They've expanded the scope of what they're doing. Those are pretty awesome. I would say those are some more innovative ways in which the government has done business. And they're also looking to do more with small businesses. I know there's been a recent ruling on the quote, rule of two for adequate competition from small businesses. So if you go out there and you do your market research and you determine that there are at least two or more small businesses that can reasonably perform this work, then they're going to want you to do a small business set aside. I mean, that's the rule of two. There was a contradiction though, and there were a lot of IDIQ contracts out there, multiple award contracts out there, where a government agency will say, well, hey, we already have this existing vehicle. We don't need to deal with doing open market and doing the rule of two and doing set asides. Based off of the regulations, we should be able to just use this existing procurement vehicle, get our product or service fast like this. And then that's what they were doing, and they weren't applying the rule of two. Now it's been determined through court that they're going to have to apply that rule of two to any multiple award contracts and EIDIQs. So that's another way that they're going to start encouraging more small business opportunities. And I think that's going to be huge, because I know a lot of government agencies just see what IDIQ vehicles they have in-house or other agencies have that they can just piggyback off and then use those. So I think those are multiple ways that we'll see some changes.
I like all those. Those are some pretty creative strategies that I didn't know about. The one that you were just talking about, that easy BAA, that sounds like a really cool one. As we're winding down here, I just kind of love to hear what your maybe most rewarding and least fun things are about being a contracting officer, because I know it's a very interesting job.
I think the most rewarding is I really enjoy the mission everywhere I've worked. When I was at DOD supporting warfighters overseas, when I was at Health and Human Services and just happened to be there when once in a lifetime pandemic hit and supporting the effort there. And then now serving the local government here in the district as a district resident for a number of years. I love being able to walk down the street, see some of the projects that we're working on, see some of the bridges, tunnels, roadways, things we're redesigning, rehabilitating, all the infrastructure money that we're spending. I mean, that's rewarding to me. That's the awesome part of the job. I would say the least enjoyable part of the job would probably be the way in which, at least in the federal sector, it's just changes moved slowly, especially in the larger agencies. When I was at DOD, it's really hard to get changes implemented. It takes a while. Versus when I was at BARDA, more of a mid-sized agency, happened relatively faster. I mean, we could definitely do things differently than I'd ever experienced before. And then going to local government, I mean, it's fair game a lot of times. I mean, there's certain regulations that we obviously have to follow, but if you want to implement some changes, you know, I'm one layer away from city council and the mayor and making requested changes and getting industry to lobby for those and things like that. So that to me is the federal sector's the slowness, the bureaucratical structure of it. And then also in general, I think that to what we were discussing earlier, I don't think that when new employees come on board, the training encourages more innovative ways of thinking. Like they go through all the procedures and the regulations and the processes of being a contracting officer, but they don't really go into a critical thought case study and really think about how you would apply a new and innovative way of doing business based off of what you've learned, instead of just answering a quiz on an assignment based off of things that you studied in a study guide. That to me is something that I would like to see changed.
Well, hopefully we can all keep lobbying for that and make those changes. You know, I think the average person, when they look at the government, and even like with me, I'll get comments on YouTube and other places like, how dare you, you know, and be called nasty names, you know, working with the government. The government's so evil and they hate it and everything. And I'm like, look, I can understand you not liking politicians, because there's two things people don't like. It's lawyers and politicians are both, right? I get that. And it's every politician a lot of times, right? It doesn't matter how nice they say. But there are so many people, whether they are in uniform or whether they are civilian, that are making things happen. They are, like you said, making sure contracts are getting done for roads and bridges and all these cool things. That's one of my favorite aspects, too. Of when I hear something and there's a warfighter, used to be in Iraq or Afghanistan or wherever, and you're hearing about them using your tool, or using your client's products, or how it saved lives, or how they planned a Special Forces recovery mission, or any of those kind of things, you're like, this is why I do it. As a former soldier, supporting them and seeing that, or just making sure that some of the programs that we have on this side are supporting the rest of America. You know, that's a really rewarding side of it. Dealing with the bureaucrats and the policies, not a lot of fun, but there's so many people that have a good heart who are trying to do good things. It's so awesome to see those projects and things come to fruition. So it's a lot of fun for us too. I love that. Thank you for reaching out and suggesting this topic. I was glad to get to talk to you and kind of go through all this stuff. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely. Happy to be here. I think what you're doing is great, educating industry. And it's part of what I want to do too, kind of bridge the gap between the way the government operates and how private industry sees it. So I appreciate it.
I really hope you enjoyed the podcast today. If you did, I would really appreciate it if you would like and subscribe to the podcast and screenshot it and tag me on LinkedIn or whatever social media you use. So thank you again for joining us today, and we'll see you next time.